Our reading this morning is adapted from a reading by the Reverend Gordon B. McKenham entitled Truck Driver. The other day I was driving on an expressway. These days, expressway driving seems a frantic enterprise. Near one of the exit ramps, one of the highway denizens, a behemoth semi, had pulled over onto the berm. The driver had emerged and was gathering some wild plants along the side of the road. And in that moment, another stereotype bit the dust. I know what truck drivers are like. They are strong, burly masters of profanity, rootless gypsies who have neither homes nor families. They care not for the wit of sunsets, mountain peaks, seashores, or wildflowers. But now I have seen one take time to stop and look carefully at the splendor by the roadside. I've been by that very spot numerous times, and not once did I take the time or trouble to stop and look at the miracle of leaf and flower. Goodbye, shattered image. I think I shall not miss you at all. You were, it should be said, quite convenient. You allowed me the luxury of not having to think of truck drivers as real people, as varied and vast as the diversity of wildflowers. Stereotypic thinking does not impart solidarity or dimensionality on an object. Quite the opposite. It dispenses with details and eliminates the differences that make individuals a member of a class of things, all of which have identical characteristics. Well, I guess all truck drivers do have a common characteristic. They all drive trucks. That, though, may exhaust the list of characteristics they share. There's one of them, at least, who notices what is growing beside the road. Quite a feat, actually, at 70 miles an hour.
We Unitarian Universalists are generally a polite bunch. Your ministerial search committee has promoted this beyond categorical thinking weekend through pulpit announcements, emails, and newsletter articles. Just this morning, I read the latest newsletter where an MSC article summarizes the results of the congregational survey, an important tool in the ministerial search process. Everyone we've met since coming here on Friday night has been gracious and warm, but I'm sure that many of you are thinking, who are they? Why are they really here? Haven't we had enough cottage meetings, congregational meetings, surveys, workshops, small group discussions about our ministerial search? Well, it might be best to tell you what we're not here to do. We're volunteers, not paid UU staff. Part of a cadre who are both lay and clergy who are trained to do this work. We're not here to represent the interests of the UUA, the Southern region, or even your MSC, because it's you, using the resources of your committee, whom you've entrusted to bring you the best fit for your ministry, and the gifts of your interim minister who has led you through the often difficult work necessary to prepare for a new chapter, and other denominational resources available to you that will result in the call of your next settled minister or ministry. This will be especially joyful for Williamsburg UUs because you will plan to welcome both a new minister and a newly expanded campus. What Amanda and I are here to do this weekend in both the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop, which took place yesterday, and in today's services, is to facilitate the deepening and widening of the process of determining the person or persons who will best fit your congregation's needs. The persons who may or may not come in the gender, color, sexual preference, ability package you initially envision. You may be thinking to yourself, well, why shouldn't I be able to express my heart and headfelt preferences? Why can't I be honest about feeling uncomfortable with people who fall into certain racial, ethnic, gender, sexual, and ability categories? Well, you can, because of congregational polity. But we hope you will acknowledge the discomfort and stay with it, own it, and then explore another way, another path. As a UU for more than 25 years, I think our shared faith is positioned to reach the beloved community of which so many of us speak, where who a person is not defined by categories, but by more profound aspects of themselves. The UUA has made many attempts to address and eradicate the barriers that have made this a 96% white denomination. I've been at the heights of hope and the depths of despair, and even disgust. I've been tempted to leave, but what keeps me here is the opportunity to know myself and know the other, and to break down the barriers that separate us. So I stay, working on many things at many levels. I am active in my congregation and at the regional and denominational level. But most of my work and much of my passion in recent years has focused on creating the beloved community within my own church. I was very moved when we pulled up on Friday and saw the Black Lives Matter banner in front of your congregation's building, and I'm really looking forward to the placement of our banner at my church in Adelphi sometime soon. As the end of the year approaches, it is usually both a tumultuous and reflective time of year for me. Like a knitter, I look back to pick up the threads of unkept commitments and resolutions and stitch them together with new interests and passions into a refreshed pattern for my life going forward into the new year. I review my list of to-dos and charities to support during the upcoming year, and I review my commitment to this movement, particularly the work related to our first principle. Since 2012, I have found myself much more connected to this denomination by my transformative experiences during the 2012 General Assembly in Phoenix, Arizona. How many people who were here went? I know there was one person at the early service. Our denomination made a controversial decision in 2010 in reaction to Arizona's passage of a blatantly racist anti-immigrant law. Instead of joining a boycott of Arizona by pulling our planned 2012 GA out of Phoenix, we voted to go there in 2012, but to make it a Justice General Assembly, where the usual business was minimized and the focus was on social justice. I've been to 22 General Assemblies. I'm what's known as a GA junkie. But I knew that this would be a different kind of one from the day I walked into the Phoenix Center. The UUA had directional signs in English and Spanish. There were opportunities for simultaneous Spanish translation in most of the workshops and program functions. Now, I believe that UUs are among the most interesting people on the planet. I've stretched my intellectual, emotional, and spiritual muscles being part of this denomination. But what I saw during this Justice GA in 2012 left me in awe. I saw Unitarian Universalists being humble. Now, we UUs are many things, but humble is not a word that comes to mind in describing us. But I actually witnessed a body of folks, nearly 3,600 people, who came to listen and take in, to ask, how can we be of service, and wait for the answer, not merely take notes, but to work in collaboration and partnership, rather than in a kind of post-colonial, we'll help you by identifying your problem and providing or directing you to the solution kind of way. Nowhere was this made more manifest than the third witness event, a protest at Tent City, the outdoor jail in the Phoenix desert, where the sheriff, with either the avid consent or willful blindness of the electorate, keeps about 2,000 potential deportees in inhumane conditions. All during the week, we UUs were educated and psychologically prepared for this final witness. Our partners in Arizona were present and doing most of the talking and teaching. On Saturday afternoon, the GA moderator gave us a strong caution as she outlined the stressful conditions under which we would be protesting. We would go on school buses. There would be no way back early once we arrived. Nighttime temperatures would be well over 100 degrees. There would be a strong possibility of armed and vocal counter-protesters. I thought long and hard about attending. I've got bad knees, and I was worried about my ability to do the physical work of witness. Apparently, many people had this same reflection, and like me, decided to go. 3,000 UUs went to the desert, many of us seniors. 3,300 youth went to the desert. Some of us were in scooters and wheelchairs and were transported in accessible vans, and the rest of us went in the buses. UU ministers donned clerical collars and or stoles to provide a strong pastoral presence and to emphasize the spiritual nature of our work. We waved battery-operated candles. We let our light shine. We sang, we prayed, we witnessed. We were there in deep humility, in partnership with those who were locked inside Tent City and those who protested just outside on a daily basis. As we left to return to our buses, a swell of protesters, those who were there daily but who had family and friends in Tent City, reached out to touch us and to thank us as we returned to the buses. That's when I realized that until nearly 3,000 UUs showed up in the desert, our partners weren't sure that we'd be there. Their faces said it all, that they were surprised and grateful. We acted instead of just talked. I am looking forward to this year's General Assembly in New Orleans, where again there will be less talk and more witness about the Black Lives Matter movement and other critical issue of our times. One of the things that I've learned from our continuing work is we don't have to look like others to stand with them. There was a term that was used at every general session and in many of the workshops during the Justice GA in Phoenix, cultural humility, meaning that understanding culture is complex and ever-changing, and committing to a lifelong process of self-reflection and self-critique about your own biases, your own faulty assumptions, and your own misperceptions. I am now convinced that cultural humility is the strongest tool we have to work in our work toward the beloved community. We must break down the barriers that divide us and construct alliances of equals that enrich us all. So, as the new year approaches, I have reaffirmed my decision of 25 years ago to take my seat and stay in it at the welcome table, and to do what I can as an individual and in community with others to open my arms to the stranger. In the words of Reverend Peter Morales, the president of our denomination, someone, a long-lost relative of the human family, is coming into our lives. At church, it happens every single Sunday. May you and I be strong as we raise our arms to recognize and say, welcome, welcome to the stranger.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. There we go. See, I know you get it. Kids are great leaders, aren't they? They just, you know, they get you going. I want to first say thank you to your ministerial selection committee, your search committee, to your interim minister, to your musicians, and to everyone who attended our workshop yesterday. We have felt warmly greeted and welcomed, and we thank you for making this day so delightful. "I have two mommies," she proudly exclaimed, in that resounding voice that only a toddler can muster. You know, the kind of voice that demands your attention and seems to have a permanently broken volume control. There, standing in the grocery checkout line early on a Saturday morning, my then 2-year-old daughter, Adeline, had once again decided that the friendly cashier who had innocently asked her how old she was, obviously really was asking if my cherub-faced toddler had a mommy and a daddy. This scene had played out several times over the preceding weeks, in the bank, at the shoe store, the doctor's office, the post office, everywhere. Adeline seemed to be wholly possessed by this particular fact of her life, and she felt inclined to share that news with anybody and everybody who dared within 30 feet of her. As every time before, this scene proceeded much like a scripted play. The cashier's friendly smile skewed a bit. She looked at me searchingly, and with confusion written all over her face, she said, "What did you say, honey?" And like every time before, I quickly jumped in. "Oh, you know toddlers. Who knows what she says? I can barely understand half of everything. Oh my, what a unique ring." Only this time was different. This time, my precious daughter sat in the cart in front of me at eye level. This time, I couldn't help but catch her gaze and see the confusion and the shame starting to take root. This time, I felt the anguish of a parent realizing that I had just taught my child a lesson that I instantly wished I could take back. In that moment of rapid diversion, the verbal sleight of hand, the redirection of a potentially uncomfortable confrontation, I had taught my daughter to be ashamed of our family. I had taught her the fear that I knew. I had taught her the beginning steps of a dance that I had swore to protect her from. I had made a decision to neatly pack up that moment in a box, tie it with a pretty ribbon, one that made my existence as both a parent and a lesbian easier for the world to digest, or better yet, just ignore. From the earliest of ages, we're taught to put things into categories. Any Sesame Street fan, parent, grandparent, caretaker of a Sesame Street fan knows the famous song. "One of these things, not like the other. One of these things just does not belong." At 1 year of age, children are able to distinguish difference. Those categories provide our lives with order, with structure, understanding, and even comfort. Those categories let us know where things or people belong. I, as I imagine most people do, have spent a great deal of time thinking about where I belong. And yesterday, we encouraged you to think about who belongs here with you, in this community, in this pulpit. Our goal is to start a conversation, to help you unpack your boxes, to see what is held and just possibly what is hiding inside. Many of you got to know me a little bit yesterday, but for those who didn't, I'd like to share a bit. You see, I grew up in Alabama, the first grandchild in a very large, very proper Southern family. I was brought up to be attentive to all of the best Southern graces. I can still set a formal table with my eyes closed. I attended college, was active in my community. I performed in voice, theater, and concert symphony. I was the apple of my family's eye. And I sat on a pedestal that was not only high, but precariously grounded in my ability to do no wrong. And God forbid, don't embarrass the family. Needless to say, my fall from that pedestal was a long but very quick descent. I was 22 years old when I came out as a lesbian and gay rights activist on CNN. You heard me. CNN, your station for up-to-date news. I will admit that my decision to give an interview to the local TV station at the annual Gay Pride Festival in Birmingham, not my brightest idea. But in my defense, I had no way of knowing that CNN would pick up the feed or, furthermore, that some aunt three times removed would happen to be watching and pick up the phone to call my very conservative grandmother. The fallout was not pretty. My mother had known my secret for a while, and being the loving woman that she is, she was really only concerned with my safety and happiness. I wish I could say the same for the rest of my family, who for nearly 12 years felt betrayed, ashamed, and horribly embarrassed. I'm happy to say that after time and a few great-grandchildren, things have greatly improved, and my family now mostly accepts and loves my partner and our children with open but not necessarily public arms. I had only unpacked my identity in a very limited way for my family. I had allowed them to only see the pieces of me that I thought they could handle. They only saw the proper, well-mannered, always amenable, eager to please side of me. It could be argued that if they had dug a little bit deeper, looked a little bit harder, or if I had felt just a little bit safer, perhaps they would have seen the other pieces of my life. They would have found another side of me, another aspect of me that makes me me. But once they were allowed to see those parts of my life that identify me as a lesbian, all other accomplishments and identities were erased. Gone was the time spent in theater. Gone were the hundreds of volunteer hours that earned me nearly full scholarship to college. Gone were the hundreds and hundreds of plays, concerts, medals, and awards. Gone was my identity as the beloved grandchild, and all were replaced with an otherness, an inability to see me as a whole person. Emerson wrote, "People only see what they are prepared to see." And it's a sad reality that our lives very seldom prepare us to challenge what we think we know. On New Year's Eve 2000, I came out to my former roommate from college. And for the next year, she would introduce me as, "This is my lesbian friend, Amanda." And I could never decide if this pronouncement was a badge of honor or a tidy warning label. And I believe that fair is fair. So I began introducing her as, "This is my Jewish friend, Gase." This confused her. But after a little bit, she began to understand the problem. And I'm sure you see my point here. Even though she had known me for many years prior to my coming out, by labeling me, she had created a social shorthand, boxing me up neatly to give social cues to the rest of the world. And in doing so, she had unintentionally stripped me of every other identity. I am confident there is not one person sitting here today that is one-dimensional. We've all spent our lives trying on new identities, casting off those which we outgrow, and evolving into who we are today, in this moment, in this space. We've learned how to unpack our identities. And far too often, to only unpack them for the rest of the world, when we feel safe. What I've shared with you this morning are mere fragments of my story, small snapshots of a lifetime. My identity has shaped me, it's hindered me at times, and it's compelled me to become a beyond categorical thinking trainer. My experiences with identity constantly reaffirm my belief that it is essential to hear each other's stories, to understand each other's truths, and to meet people where they are, lest we fall into the trap of boxing them up for our comfort. As I buckled her into her car seat, Adeline spoke for the first time since I had hurriedly redirected the cashier's attention. "I have two mommies," she said in a near whisper. And as I looked at those sapphire blue eyes that resemble my own, I couldn't help but feel the tears well. I shook my head in affirmation, afraid my voice would betray me. I laid my forehead to hers in our shared gesture of affection since her birth. "My mommies love me very much," she said. That assured confidence of one who will never be swayed. "Yes," I said, "very much." And there it was, from the heart of a child demanding to be acknowledged for her story, for her identity, separate from my own, I was reminded again that the work never ends. The boxes we pull behind us, the boxes we struggle to break free from, the boxes where we seek refuge must never, never be allowed to be the sole measure of our identity. There is not a box big enough to contain our messy lives and our ever-changing identities. Yesterday, we asked many of you to look inside of your boxes, to dig deep into the dark and scary places, to stretch, possibly bust a few seams here and there. And today I'd like to ask you to continue that conversation. My prayer is that you will witness the transformative power of really knowing someone beyond labels, beyond categories, and most certainly beyond boxes. Blessed be God.